gonna sit back.
Okay.
Okay, then we continue our discussion with insurance, and in particular about the different effective dates of IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard. Give the floor to Andrea.
Thank you. Okay, hello everyone. So this Wednesday we will be publishing the exposure draft of proposed amendments to IFRS 4. That's to address the issues related to the implementation of IFRS 9 financial instruments together with IFRS 4 insurance contracts. The exposure draft has a comment period of 60 days and will end on the 8th of February. Today, we are going to be asking you to consider the information that we were hoping we would obtain from the exposure process and to ask for your help in providing information that will be useful for us in our deliberations on the exposure draft. So as we've previously indicated in other forums, we find it most helpful when national standard setters and regional bodies develop comment letters with input from their local jurisdiction and explain to us the work that's been undertaken to develop the comment letter, the views of constituents within that jurisdiction, including, where applicable, any differing views amongst constituents within an individual jurisdiction, and also the national standard setter regional bodies' analysis and recommendations, taking into consideration all those different views. And we like that because those letters provide us with a very rich source of information that allow us to best develop the final amendment. Now, I think that ASAF members have had different levels of involvement in the various debates and discussions about the issues and potential solutions for the different effective dates of IFRS 9 and the insurance contract standard. So I thought it would be useful just to step back and remind you a bit about the context for this exposure draft. So going back to July 2014, the ISB issued IFRS 9, which sets out the requirements for recognising and measuring financial instruments and replaced IAS 39. The effective date of IFRS 9 was the 1st of January 2018 and early application was permitted. We're also now at a fairly advanced stage of our project to replace IFRS 4. But we've already indicated that we expect to allow a prolonged implementation period for IFRS 4, and this means that the earliest possible mandatory effective date of the new insurance contract standard is going to be after the effective date of IFRS 9, so after the 1st of January 2018. Now, many interested parties told us it would be best if the effective dates of IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard could be aligned, and they've been telling us that for some time, to be fair. And recently we've heard three main reasons for why that should be the case. First, they were concerned that users of financial statements might find it difficult to understand the additional accounting mismatches and temporary volatility that could arise in profit or loss if IFRS 9 is applied before the new insurance contract standard. And that additional volatility would arise if contracts that are accounted for at cost under IFRS 4 would later be accounted for at current value applying a new insurance contract standard, and you keep the same accounting on the assets, meaning that there's mismatch in one period or the other. Second, they're also concerned about having to apply the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9 before the effects of the new insurance contract standard can be properly evaluated, and that's because we haven't yet finished our deliberations on the new insurance contract standard. And third, they're concerned about the two sets of major accounting changes in a short period that they think could result in cost and effort for both users and preparers of financial statements. So we considered, we debated those concerns, and we first of all noted that the existing standards we have, IFRS 4 in particular, already allow entities to address at least part of those concerns. And we also noted that the evaluation of the costs needed to be done with the assumption that the entity will be needing to apply IFRS 9 in any case. So we thought that, for example, one-time transition costs should not be considered decisive in what we do. We need to be thinking about it in terms of ongoing costs. We're also aware that many users of financial statements will need to understand the changes that arise from IFRS 9 and financial statements more generally. We're not just looking at people who are only looking at the financial statements of insurance companies. And so regardless of any sort of deferral we might permit, users already need to understand IFRS 9 in any case from the beginning of January 2018. And then in the main insurance contracts project, the ISB decided to extend transition reliefs proposed to entities so that when they apply the new insurance contract standard with IFRS 9, they'll be able to reassess particular aspects of the classification of their financial assets. And that would mean that they, that would address the concerns that about applying the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9 without being able to fully evaluate the effects of the new insurance contract standard before implementing IFRS 9. Because they would get the opportunity to reassess at that time. But that all being said, we were still sympathetic to the idea that without amending the existing standards, it would be difficult for us to adequately address the concerns that have been expressed about additional accounting mismatches and temporary volatility. So as a result of all that, we propose in this exposure draft two options in IFRS 4. The first would permit an entity that issues insurance contracts to reclassify from profit or loss to other comprehensive income some of the income or expenses that arise from designated financial assets, and it's designated at the choice of the entity. That approach would be available to all insurers that are affected by the different effective dates of IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard, and so it would permit all those entities to remove from profit or loss any additional accounting mismatches or temporary volatility that arises from applying IFRS 9 with IFRS 4. The second option that we're proposing in the exposure draft is a temporary exemption. We've previously talked about it as the deferral approach. It's a temporary exemption from applying IFRS 9 and is targeted only at entities that engage purely in activities that result in contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. And because the first approach, the overlay approach, solves what we would consider to be the main issue that's left to be solved for all entities, the second option would be available to much fewer entities. And as a result, we've decided it should apply only to entities whose predominant activity is issuing contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. So in this exposure draft, we will have six questions in the invitation to comment, which ask for input on how to assess the need to address these concerns. The proposal to allow two options rather than one or none in the for addressing those concerns, and the operation of both the overlay approach and the temporary exemption. We're also asking on whether the approaches should be permitted or required and what the consequences of that are, and on the proposal that the temporary exemption should have a stated endpoint, it would disappear after 2021. And in reviewing the comment letters to the exposure draft, we intend to be paying particular attention to the information that will help us understand how best to balance the costs of implementing the amendments. And those costs have two sides to them. There's the costs in terms of operational costs of implementation for preparers, but then there is also the costs of lost or unhelpful or confusing information that might arise if those approaches were to be implemented. And in particular, because we still see the overlay approach as the main way in which we sought to address the concerns expressed, we want to make sure that we have a solid understanding of the issues relating to the overlay approach so that we can ensure that it actually serves its purpose as being the primary means through which we can address these concerns about accounting volatility. With that, I'd like to open it up to any questions or comments you might have on this exposure draft, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Question that I had in that agenda paper on the illustrative statement of comprehensive income. You've got there that line item investment income and then reclassified amount being the overlay adjustment. Mm-hmm. Just to understand, is that investment income line what IFRS 9 would require?
I think it could depend on which of the presentation approaches the entity would choose. So some entities might choose to present an IFRS 9 investment income and then an adjustment separate, or you could present one which is already adjusted, which would effectively be IAS 39 investment income. So because we're not being strict on, we're not specifying what presentation approach people need to take, you could have either.
I suppose maybe what confused me a little bit was that it almost looked like the reclassification was below profit or loss, but I'm assuming that that's not correct. That there has to be a reclassification
above and below.
Above profit or loss, and the other side of the entry is sitting in OCR, whereas this almost looked like it was a reclassification below the line in the picture.
If you prepare the top half of the income statement in accordance with IAS 39, it essentially already incorporates that adjustment above and beyond.
Okay.
And we've not been prescriptive on whether you should
okay.
use above the line IS39
okay.
or IS39.
Just I think maybe the picture is a little bit misleading. It sort of looks, with that arrow going down, it sort of looks like that is then reclassified. So that's, I was a little bit confused. But I gathered just from the wording that there had to be an adjustment above profit or loss.
And a choice on presentation, but I think we say there has to be one line somewhere that shows the total effect of the overlay adjustment, which could be as a single line adjustment in P&L or as a single item in OCI, as is shown on that slide.
And then, is it clear as to what happens when the new insurance contract standard is applied?
Well, that would be dealt with in the transition provisions of the new insurance contract standard. So we've got some tentative decisions so far, but that hasn't been through the full ballot writing up procedure, so we don't actually have the written words for how that's affected yet.
Okay.
Linda?
So I want to just make sure that we're aware that these comments are based on not having actually seen the words that we're talking about.
Absolutely.
So it's always fun to do that. So we have talked to our constituents, mainly two groups. One would be the large banks who have major insurance operations, and the other would be the so-called pure insurers. Because when we last spoke about this, one of my concerns was giving a deferral to the pure insurers, but the banks not having some option to deal with that. And I know that the overlay approach is designed to do that. So our banks have been very clear that they will not take advantage of the overlay approach simply because they feel that it is too difficult to maintain two different standards within one entity. We have processes that involve internal control certifications, which are costly. So to maintain two sets of documentation for that is, in their view, too risky. Too costly, and frankly, they are going live with IFRS 9 starting November 1st, 2017, because the local prudential regulator has required them to go a year earlier than their year ends would have required. So they are full tilt on IFRS 9, and that will include their insurance operations, and they have no interest in picking up the overlay approach. So that said, it certainly does not appear that anybody in Canada is interested in the overlay approach. The Canadian insurers are very much interested.
And how do these banks, they seem to, so they are just digesting the problem.
In all cases, their insurance operations, while significant, are not so significant that they want to take the risk of trying to do two standards at the one time. And getting to the finish line for the November 1st, 2017 go with IFRS 9 is taking all the resources that they have to get there.
Right.
So they are very clear. We've had the discussions, and they're very clear on this. From the Canadian insurer's perspective, they are only interested in the deferral method. They have all signed on to the hub insurance letter that you got, Hans, recently. They have raised the issues that you've cited, Andrea. In particular, they cite they don't want to do IFRS 9 twice. And they also cite some internal impairment processes they don't want to put in place for a short period of time. Because their intention when the new insurance standard is in play is to use fair value through P&L as much as possible. And we're dealing with some other local regulatory issues that would enhance that, but that's not... doesn't need to be covered here. The concern right now is, in looking at what we've heard about the deferral approach, again, we haven't seen the words, is that there's some issue around whether or not our insurers would actually qualify, whether the predominance test would work or not work, and how it would apply. And this largely is the life insurance companies. So far, P&C is fairly quiet. Okay? So we'll continue our discussions. We will focus our discussions, especially once we see the document on Wednesday, around looking at the wording in the predominance test and seeing how that would apply in our case. And clearly, if we come back and have issues, we will do our very best to provide a constructive recommendation of things that we think would work. And hopefully we will be able to do that taking into consideration a global view as opposed to a Canada-only view. So early days, but that's where we stand.
Okay. Andreas?
Thanks, Hans. Some indicative feedback and a question probably up front as regards the presentation of the overlay approach and following up from what Kim has said. Have you been in contact with any users on the dual display of the profit or loss account or the statement of comprehensive income? The reason I'm asking is when we had a preliminary outreach with users, we were being told that if you do have an IFRS 9 balance sheet, wouldn't it make more sense to also have an IFRS 9 profit or loss with some sort of tweak at the end, rather than having an IAS 39 P&L to go with an IFRS 9 balance sheet, because that was seen as being confusing. I agree that you could probably reconstruct everything, but the feedback that we got, if you want to go for an IAS 39 or retain the IAS 39 profit or loss, shouldn't you be also having a profit a balance sheet on IAS 39? That was one of the questions.
So if I could just clarify, they would prefer that we restrict the presentation
yes.
approach, okay?
Yes. So I don't know whether you've received any indicative feedback on that one.
So, I mean, my recollection was we need to do more outreach with them, obviously, once we publish the document, which we haven't started yet. But the reason why we actually went with the dual presentation suggestion in the board papers was as a result of some of the outreach we did with investors, where they were not so, at that time, focused on what the individual line items were so much as knowing overall what the effect was. So the key thing that they sort of honed in on was having on the face somewhere the single line item where you could see what the overall effect of the overlay adjustment was. So that's why we went with the alternatives, and also in part because in some of the discussions we initially had with some of the insurance companies, they felt that it might be better for them if they were using the overlay approach to be able to show a sort of full IAS 39 view of the world in P&L. But your question's a very fair one, and I think one we're going to try and drill down into with the investors now that we've actually got the two alternatives on the table.
Philippe, you want to add?
I think that nevertheless, the term overlay in itself implies what more or less what you say. You do a IFRS 9 presentation both in the P&L and then you overlay the adjustment. Otherwise, we would have used a different term. I agree with Sue that we have not been so prescriptive, but I think the philosophy, the whole idea is overlay.
That's something that I suggest looking into. In terms of indicative feedback, I know that our large insurers are already in contact with you, and the indicative feedback that we got is that they would qualify under the predominance test. Some noise we've heard around this is is the predominance test currently technically set up the right way, which is if the objective is to single out quote unquote pure insurers, shouldn't you be concentrating then really on things that are indicative of insurance business and scope everything out that has nothing to do with either banking or insurance or any other business? For instance, pension liabilities. Are they indicative of any business model?
Yeah.
Not, no, don't think so. So if you set up the ratio and really want to find out are you a quote unquote pure insurer, yes or no, then you might think about leaving some things out in calculating that ratio. The one concern that we have is on one conglomerate, and I have not come across another one, and I know that conglomerate has written to you as well. So after the financial crisis, the vast majority of the conglomerates have all gone from Germany. They have all wound up, and they are now either banks or insurers, or they are insurers with very, very tiny banks or large banks with very tiny insurance. But there's one conglomerate left, and they are interested in applying the deferral, which, by the way, how the proposals are set up, they couldn't qualify unless you would go below the reporting entity level. And that comes back to another question, that is, how confident, how satisfied are you with some banking activities not being accounted for under IFRS 9? I think that's probably the question. If you're sure with the pure insurer argument, because I think obviously you open up the ratio, the more banking activities could slip through. If you want to avoid that, you either make it tighter or you go a level below and keep it pure. Say, regardless of whether you are a bank freestanding or within a conglomerate, you have to apply IFRS 9 full stop. And only insurers could qualify for any sort of either overlay or deferral. I realize that this comes up obviously with technicalities, because it's much easier if you apply the entire thing through the entire group for the very same reasons that Linda's just mentioned. Would I think it to be unsolvable? Not necessarily. However, you would probably never go for finding a population up to 100%. You would always lose some on either end, and that I'm quite certain.
I think it's worth remembering when we use the words like pure insurers, what we're trying to get at, and we're not really necessarily trying to get at business models of companies or anything like that. What we're looking at is, given that we're dealing with accounting mismatch, temporary volatility, financial statement effects, which companies' financial statements are dominated by the contracts that are subject to this anomaly in the timing of the effective dates. And that's why our focus has been very much on the contracts that are within the scope of IFRS 4 and how extensive they are compared to anything else in the financial statements. I think it's also worth remembering that we see this as a temporary thing. It's a short-term fix for a problem that will hopefully go away very quickly. Very quickly being measured in years rather than months, obviously. but relatively quickly. And so.
Instead of sitting years.
And so trying to keep it as simple as possible was one of the motivators of trying to be, you know, going for a single anchor, being clearer about what it is in and out, and not developing very complex rules which will inevitably have other companies which are just on the other side of the dividing line on it in any case. In terms of being satisfied that some banking activities might or might not sneak in on the net, I think we are sanguine that we have to accept that risk. We could, of course, raise the predominant threshold way up, but that wouldn't necessarily be, that might be counterproductive as well. So we've thought that where we were with this predominance threshold and still at the reporting to entity level balances, trying to keep it relatively simple, not having a lot of detailed prescription guidance in there, with, you know, achieving what we mostly want to achieve, which is that most people should be applying IFRS 9.
Alberto.
Thank you. Following on what Andrea said about calculating this predominance ratio, our insurers have also raised the same point that some liabilities which cannot be strictly related, cannot be considered to be strictly related to insurance, should be excluded. And okay, the pension is one, income taxes liability, deferred income taxes is another item. And there is a specific one which has been identified, and that is the subordinated debts. Because these are considered equity for regulatory purposes. And so having this hybrid nature of being equity for regulators, being liability for financial statements, they believe that they should be excluded in the calculation of the predominance ratio. And the second point that has been raised is that why this option of deferral shouldn't be available for the first-time adopter. We might have quite a number of first-time adopters in our country, because we are moving and we are considering to, you know, that in our country those companies which are obliged to use IFRS for consolidated accounts are also obliged to do that for separate accounts, with one exception, the insurers. The insurers do not, but the legislator now wants them to be on the same page. So there will be a lot of first-time adopters, which are the insurers which did follow IFRS because they don't have a consolidated accounts before. So they will be first-time adopters, and they believe that the deferral option should be fair, that is available to them as well.
Could I ask what the time scale is for that lifting of the prohibition of IFRS for insurance companies?
When we have to deal with Parliament and government, I make no guess.
But there's nothing but actually concrete
they said
at the moment.
Very soon. I mean,
certainly before
2018. Certainly before 2018. So.
The reasoning we had for not having the deferral approach and the overlay approach available to first-time adopters is because we're trying to solve for people who are moving from IS 39 to IFRS 9 and the problems that they have there. If you're coming from another gap, then the first-time adopter philosophy is that people have time to make an orderly transition to IFRS, and so they should be able to take whatever preventative measures they need within that context.
They still don't have the new insurance standard.
But it will be published by the time that they have it, I think. They'll be able to know what it says.
Sue, did you want to come in?
I just wanted to respond actually to something Andreas raised before on the conglomerates. I think that's why it's particularly important for us to really get a detailed understanding of what the costs are associated with the overlay approach, because I sort of think the way that our logic works in our exposure draft is we've tried to target a small set of entities that are really, most of their balance sheet is affected by the fact that their insurance contracts accounting is going to change, and that's why we get these tensions with what's in the ratio, but that's sort of what we've gone for. And then we've sort of working on the assumption that for other entities, including conglomerates, the overlay approach is a sort of reasonable way of dealing with the volatility question. But that's based on a sort of series of assumptions about how costly that would be relative to the benefits that it brings. And that's why we really need to have a good understanding of exactly what the costs are, and not just from the perspective of, I really want the deferral, therefore I'll throw all of the arguments I can think of at the overlay approach, but really, and I'm not saying that sort of disingenuously, but really a thorough understanding of what the costs are, so we can make sure we haven't sort of miscalculated in our assessment of cost benefit of the overlay approach. That would really help us.
Jim?
The insurance working group in AOSSG, they appreciate that the IASB has tentatively decided to propose the deferral approach. However, working group notes that not all insurers would be able to apply the deferral approach, since the criteria for applying that approach are too restrictive. Therefore, the working group has reviewed other available alternatives to the IASB proposal. However, they did not find any of the alternative would perfectly resolve the problem. Therefore, the working group suggested that the IASB propose deferral approach as tentatively decided, but do not present the quantitative criterion of the predominance level and mitigate the level of the predominance.
Patrick?
First of all, conglomerates exist, they do exist, and I have met some. So it's not a non-issue. You have serious conglomerates with serious banking activities or insurance activities. So we need to tackle this. I think this issue needs to be tackled. In terms of objective, yes, it's a short-term issue. What we want, I think, is a simple solution, and we want something that is useful. So where the information is at one the same time faithful and relevant, if I have to believe the conceptual framework. So as a consequence, I have to admit, and we had discussions at FRAG board level on this, and a letter has been sent, I think, to the Commission on
Friday,
where we are moderately convinced by the overlay approach because of the possible confusion at P&L level between profit and loss level, between investment income, overlay adjustment, and other comprehensive income. So, I think there is a serious interest for the deferral approach, but with a slight difference. Maybe significant, but I think it's slight in the end. We all agree, and I am firmly convinced that IFRS 9 should be applied to all banking activities. So, for instance, excluding banks on the ground that they are part of an insurance group under the predominant factor, for me would be a bit surprising, because you do not create a capacity to compare banking activities, and most of the time they are treated as segments. So you would have IFRS 39 for banking activities. This is not good. On the other hand, having insurance activities in banking groups under IFRS 9, even with the overlay approach, is not ideal. So why not have the criterion at below reporting entity level, quite frankly? Because, and frankly, the transactions between the two segments are minimal. That's a point that can be addressed, I think. Technically, it's not insurmountable. And in addition, I think that in every jurisdiction that I know, insurance activities are clearly identified with vehicles that are specifically regulated. So it wouldn't be very difficult to identify those entities that would be permitted to use the deferral approach. And personally, on the basis of short-term, simple and useful solution, I think we can live short-term with insurance activities under IS39 until IFRS 4 is in force, and we do wish that to happen quickly, and banking activities under IFRS 9 instead of mixing, I think, frankly, on the basis of predominance. So this is a view which I wanted to share.
Daryl?
I just want to say something a little bit along the lines of what I think Sue was saying, that I think when it comes to the opportunity to defer something, or to defer particularly an accounting change, preparers are inherently procrastinators. They will delay wanting to change anything as long as possible. And certainly the discussions that I've had with a number of insurers is they sort of started with the fact that they want to defer and then have tried to back engineer themselves into a deferral solution. All of which suggests that there's probably no solution that's going to make everybody happy as far as deferral is concerned. So I think to an extent, what the thing that for me would be really, really important in the process of exposing, and I think where we would look to you guys, is to make sure that there's not such a total focus on deferral that people forget about the overlay approach until it's too late and they have to deal with whatever the overlay approach is. So it's just making sure that people in the jurisdictions you're coming from are focusing on the individual overlay approach, on the assumption that there's a chance they may have to apply that approach and that they figure out that they know the solution to that. Obviously, for the rest, it's a matter of a exposure process. We're exposing, we're going to listen to what we hear through that exposure process. But it really is important that I think the worst answer we can get is absolute silence on overlay, or a trashing of overlay, only for people to find afterwards that they didn't actually consider the implications.
If those costs are so prohibitive, as people are telling us, we haven't seen the evidence yet.
Well, Hans, and I think it goes beyond the cost. I think it goes into, are there concerns with the way it is actually proposed to be implemented? And if people so focus on the cost, they ignore the way that it could be tweaked, I think we potentially have a loss of an opportunity to structure it. Structure is probably a bad word.
Patrick, you wanted to get back?
I just want to react quickly. I think we had the opportunity to meet several times and discuss several times with the insurance industry. And I think that in every discussion we had, we have insisted on the risk of procrastination. We do not consider that the deferral or the overlay is a substitute to proper investment, point one. And point two, I think we have all insisted on the fact that we wanted IFRS 4 as quickly as possible. Because this is not a way to escape. So I would like to reassure Daryl, if I may, by saying that we would not, at least I wouldn't support an initiative that would be just a tactical move, no.
Because I do get the impression sometimes that there are, that in calculating or these imaginary costs of the overlay approach, that in the background there seems to be the opinion that IFRS 9 will never be applied. Yukio.
Thank you. I have a sympathy with the concerns raised by member. Yet in Japan, many companies engaging in insurance businesses have yet to implement IFRS. So, except for limited numbers of companies, we do not foresee many cases where the IFRS 9 is implemented before new insurance contract is finalized. But in general, we have a concern that the ISB is about to publish the exposure draft on the deferral approach and the overlay approach with a strong presumption that it will finalize the insurance contract standard without formally deliberating whether re-exposure is necessary. We fully understand that the insurance contract standard is much needed. However, considering the breadth of changes having been made after the deliberation of the 2013 exposure draft, we believe it's imperative for the ISB to seriously consider whether another public consultation is necessary. In addition, considering the breadth of the changes having been made, we believe the ISB should take steps to ensure that new insurance contract standard is sufficiently understandable and operational.
A project manager.
Thank you. So the view.
You've just been promoted.
So that means the view I expressed.
There is more way.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, is ISB's view. Anyway.
That's not even true. That's still not
those
true.
Who cannot see this.
Yes,
child from China's
Chinese insurance companies and also other entities who have, you know, insurance businesses has a very big concerns about the cost and the benefit. And many of them, they believe that overlay approach may result in the cost outweighs, you know, the benefit. The reason is that first, for those companies, they have to have two systems in place. One is applying IFRS 9, one is applying IAS 39 to provide two sets of information.
Two systems, one of them which they have already,
and one of which they will have to have. Yeah, they have to have. So they have to keep two systems. It costs too much, especially for those companies have big number of, you know, financial assets, relevant to related to insurance contracts. And those investments very diverged and based on different contracts. So they have to keep two systems in place. It costs them too much. And secondly, they have concerns about the comparability. We provide option of to the companies. Some companies, they apply only approach. Some companies may not. So in same jurisdictions, different insurance companies may apply different accounting policies. So this kind of it will result in, you know, comparability will be, you know, be reduced. So especially for the insurance regulators, they're very concerned about this kind of result. And also, there are one of the criteria for this approach is designation of the, you know, criteria. But we didn't see that any criteria in which cases they can use this criteria, which cases not. The people are worried about that maybe it will leave a room for the companies to manage earnings because they're easy to work out, okay, which cases we are designating. It meets the designation criteria, which cases not. So it happened, it also will increase costs, you know, and reduce the comparabilities. And then what kind of benefit the users we can receive, can get. If we look at the income statement, actually the P&L still based on IAS 39, it seems that. So, but the users believe that all these companies actually they are using IFRS 9. So maybe those users has, if we're using overlay approach, those users has to be educated. They have to know what approach they are using and whether they will benefit this kind of so-called, you know, I think transparent information, because different information and different approach we are using. So the people are quite worried about that, whether the users can get the benefit or whether misleading with these companies really are using IFRS 9 or still using, you know, IAS 39. So in generally speaking, Chinese insurance companies or other relevant companies, that they are still favor deep flow approach.
But that might lead to lack of comparability within conglomerates.
Yeah, maybe, but to compare two approaches, because insurance companies, it's still, for China, there are only three big insurance, you know, listed companies. So it seems that the impact for them, just limited numbers, you know, of companies, yeah.
So
yeah.
You have
this
no
is
the
Chinese
you have no
yeah, 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 yeah.
They would all apply.
They are very worried about the cost, you know.
I was going to comment on the comparability point, but first of all, on the investor information point, actually, based on the outreach that we did before we made the decision, some of the investors like the overlay approach so much, some of them almost went so far as to suggest everybody should be required to do it, mm-hmm. because it would help them understand the consequences of moving from IFRS 9 to IAS 39. So we actually had to reel some of them back before they suggested the whole world should do it. But on the comparability point, if people are concerned about the comparability issues that could arise because the overlay approach is optional, are they not equally or more concerned about the fact that the deferral approach would be also optional, because then you get no IFRS 9 information, whereas at least with the overlay you get IFRS 9 information plus some IAS 39 information. So is the comparability concern not at least equally a concern for the deferral? You were only talking about the overlay, so maybe you just weren't focusing on that, but is it not similarly a concern for the deferral?
Currently, you know, people
just want to tell us why they don't like the
Yeah. Because the material is very based on your material.
Yeah.
Well, Patrick mentioned that EFRAG sent a letter to the European Commission. I think I should give just very quickly some insight into why this has been done. Basically, it's been done at the request of the European Commission itself. They wanted to be informed on the progress that the ISP had made and to help them, in fact, make a decision towards the endorsement of IFS 9. So we were indeed asked to provide very preliminary, first of all, an update, but also a very preliminary analysis of our understanding of the exposure draft that was still to be published. And to that extent, we run a very limited first consultation. And so the letter has been published indeed last Friday and is available on our website. And so we had a little insight coming from our constituents. So we identified limited but still some interest in the overlay approach for some banking groups that carry some insurance activities, but so far limited but existing. We heard about the cost that would be involved in the overlay approach, and really what we heard very much fit the description that Jean-Charles has made. So it's as if I was listening to what I heard when I heard you describe it. And the cost is not, because you would have to develop systems, because indeed one exists and the other one is to develop anyway, but it's the cost associated to running them in parallel, the extent of internal controls that you have to put in place, especially having one of the standards which is indeed by designation. So I think the cost issue cannot be dismissed, just that way. The system, one exists and one has to exist. It's really at the level, the individual booking level, with all the monitoring and that has to be made. And also taking into account that basically the overlay approach allows you to pick your own population, those financial assets that relate to liabilities in such a way that accounting mismatches would arise. So you have really this, also lot of leeway in the way you identify things and document and decide. So that's what the very wanted to highlight that, because it struck me that we received the same kind of description. The other thing I wanted to highlight is that to support also providing as much information as we could at this stage to the European Commission, there has been some study run by the EFRAG Secretariat out on the basis of the publicly available information, trying to see what would be the results of the predominance quotient as it is defined in the proposals for the default approach, and that was based on the 20 largest insurers in Europe, and the results that are published show how many you would indeed include, provided the level that the predominance criterion would be supposed to capture. And also this letter also very clearly highlights that some banking activities might be encompassed, as Andreas has described, and that is identified as a concern. So, but the real thing will be with the due process to come.
Could be a question, Françoise, about this last point, and here I'm venturing alone without the board support, so please take it as a personal comment. Have you thought about the possibility of having a reverse engineering of the overlay, i.e. to identify banking assets in a conglomerate and to say to those assets IFRS 9 apply whatever the rest of the group does?
But it does not address the conglomerate
issue when the head is a bank?
Well, when the head is a bank, then you have the question of the overlay for the insurance activities. We heard from Canada they are not interested. Okay. But if the head is an insurance company, but is a conglomerate, then what is important is that whenever you have banking assets in that group, they follow the same rules as any bank. I heard that from many of you. So have you considered that as being a possibility to address both the insurance deferral, but without the banking assets being subject to the deferral? But I'm just going on
an icy
ground, because we have not discussed it at the board level, just something which came to my mind in recent days.
I'm not sure if I understand.
The idea is, in a way, is akin to below the reporting entity level. But the below reporting entity level relies on legal entities, in a way. You have a legal entity which is a bank, a legal entity which is an insurance company, and some others which are maybe something else. But what I have in mind is, at group level, forget about the predominance test, or make it lower threshold so that the insurance group which is at the head as a conglomerate would benefit from the deferral. But as some are concerned that this might encompass banking assets and no one wants those banking assets to benefit from the deferral, there would be a kind of overlay applied to those banking assets in order that they are subject to the IFRS 9 requirements separately from the group which would still be on IS 39. I've not put it in with all the details. It's just a big concept I have here.
Just a quick point on that. So the current view, can't confirm it yet, but the early read is that for an insurer who has a small captive bank, that captive bank is locally going to be required to adopt IFRS 9. And then what we have to sort out is, do they reverse it on consolidation for their total results? But from our perspective, it seems like all of our banking activities are going to go to IFRS 9. That's what I've heard so far.
It's also my understanding that the banking regulators in Europe will want all banks to report under IFRS 9 for regulatory purposes, which would be a similar situation.
Okay.
Ask
Stephen. Yeah.
Just Patrick, one question. Patrick, you said that you would favor deferral below the reporting entity level, in part because of then you capture the banking activities under IFRS 9. Would you advocate withdrawing the option to defer at the reporting entity level in that case?
I'm sorry, say it again.
So at the moment we've said if you qualify for deferral at the reporting entity level based upon the predominance criteria, you're advocating deferring below the reporting entity level. Would you therefore withdraw, not allow deferral at the reporting entity level in that case? Or are you asking for three different options? Deferral at reporting entity level, deferral below, and the overlay?
I think that it eliminates the predominant factor, you know. It is the regulated activity criterion rather than a predominant. So it avoids the difficult computations on the basis of the liabilities. And, you know, we tested some, and you get to interesting results sometimes. So I think it would be, I would eliminate in this case. Yes.
You would say only regulated insurance entities qualify?
Yes.
The entity itself or the entity and its subsidiaries?
Well, subsidiaries, if they are regulated.
If they're regulated.
Ms. Fowler?
Well, I think we need to look into all this more carefully, but the predominance criterion could help if it was improved and helped capture. It could help, in fact, identify a subgroup that within a conglomerate that would be involved in insurance activities.
If you were to use predominance criteria below the reporting entity level, I would expect that it would be at a much higher level than predominant. It would be virtually all. Where would you put that line?
Well, I mean, we are not there yet, I would like to be very careful in what I say.
But if the purpose, I guess what I'm, it's more an observation than rather than a question, if the purpose is to avoid capturing banking activities, then virtually any trace of banking activity in that subsidiary would mean that it wouldn't be eligible, with how I would put it to you. Is that what you're trying to say?
I think you've heard Andreas, and he has already mentioned some, and Alberto mentioning how the population of liabilities could be identified differently. Either it is with the ratio, so you take some out of the total, or you put some in. there are different ways of doing it, but where you would make sure that basically the liabilities that you have and that you consider as those of an insurance entity. And I know that IFRS does not deal with particular industries, so I'm not. And so the fact that you carry insurance contract and you account for them, the liabilities for them, in accordance with IFRS 4 remain a very important condition. But you could have also some investment activities that insurance companies usually carry, where the difference between IFRS 9 and IAS 39 in the accounting would not be, you would not get any improvement from duplication. And you would make sure that you are not having any banking activities. So I don't want to get into the details how to do that, because I could say things which would not be supportable or have not been discussed yet. But indeed, trying to reach something that could be virtual or, as you mentioned, Andrea.
Can I just add a question to Stephen, just to understand. When you said below the reporting entity but not above, so if you had an insurance company as a subsidiary, but the reporting entity, you know, is predominantly, let's say, a bank. Just to understand, when you were saying, so below would mean for that insurance entity, they would be able to do something different other than just IFRS 9. But then,
suppose you have a conglomerate, two subsidiaries, one bank, one insurer.
Yeah.
Bank is 20%, insurance is 80%.
Right.
You may say it's predominantly insurance,
right,
at the moment, and therefore you get the deferral.
Completely.
Yeah, and then the problem that Patrick identified is you've got a bank which is significant but not dominant within the group, and therefore you would be applying IAS 39 to the bank. So
In the consolidated.
In the individual financial statements, you do whatever you do.
You have to do IFRS 9.
Well, it depends.
So Patrick,
So
Patrick was saying, well, why don't we apply IFRS 9 to the bank,
yes,
IAS 39 to the insurer.
And you just consolidate
that. And then you consolidate 9 and 39 right, assets, and you have one set of consolidated accounts.
Yes.
Why, I asked Patrick, well, if you're doing that, presumably you would withdraw the option of having IAS 39 for everything at the reporting entity level.
Yes, okay, I understand your question.
And that's what Patrick confirmed.
Yes, that's right, because basically anything that's banking is IFRS 9, and anything that backs insurance, you've got a choice.
And then you have segment reporting explaining a lot of other things, you know.
Yes.
So I think you might overstate the benefit of segment reporting.
If applied properly, I must say.
When people talk about the predominance test and how we could do it differently, certainly acknowledge that it could be done differently. But I think when I've been thinking about it, what I've been trying to shoot for is this sort of subset of situations where I've got an entity which has this temporary problem, if you like, where they've got something that's accounted for one way under IFRS 4 and their local GAAP, and then ultimately we're going to come along and change the way they account for those insurance contracts. If we were to switch the test around in a way that's designed more to capture insurers as in regulated entities, could we not, in theory, and I know this is an extreme, have a situation where I've got an entity which has got no contracts that are affected by the change in accounting caused by IFRS 4, or the new insurance contract standard that suddenly swept into a deferral when really they didn't have the temporary problem that we were trying to solve. So am I trying to solve for something different to what the industry is trying to solve for?
That's why I mentioned that having insurance contract liabilities carried accounted for in accordance with IFRS 4 is a necessary condition.
But my concern, I guess, is that some of the people who are concerned that they might not fall in the scope seem to be entities that might be insurers, if we think about that as a more generic concept, but they're not necessarily hugely impacted by the change in accounting, because they've got a lot of stuff that's not going to be caught by the change in accounting. But because they see themselves as insurers, they would like to be in the scope of the deferral, but it's not really what we set out to start solving for.
Andreas,
I think that may be the case, but probably need to look more deeply into that. I would like to comment on Steve's question. I'd say if you asked me that question bluntly, whether the reporting entity could go away if you push it down to the legal entity or whatever it is, then I probably would have answered yes. However, the feedback that we got from our two largest insurers, they said they would rather have it on the reporting entity level because they believe it's a simplification for them. And that means that the banking unit is so small in relation to the insurance business that they just do not see the value of actually running two systems and in parallel on the group level, which would be the result if you erase the reporting entity option and went one level below. Because then the bank would have to apply IFRS 9 and would be pushing that one up to the group level. So there might be instances where the ratio of your predominance test is so high that for them it would be beneficial actually to do it just on the reporting entity level. And it might still be the banking issue the banking subset might still be significant enough in order not to meet any materiality threshold, which would be the other way out, obviously.
So that was a very good question, Steve.
But I think, as you said, I mean, there is not a one-size-fits-all question. I mean, you will lose certain entities.
You have three different solutions.
If I may, I would just like one comment, which I feel quite strongly in the debate. I mean, apart from the technical arguments, which I absolutely appreciate, I think we should not lose sight of the fact that whatever the temporary solution is, it's a 3-year period only. So we should avoid, we are creating a monster for a 3-year interim period that is meant to go away thereafter anyway. So that's a cost benefit constraint on the standard.
That's exactly why our test is so simplistic.
Well, right, but if it is simplistic and doesn't catch the intended population, on the other hand, then it comes down to the benefit part.
But your intent is, though, doesn't it?
That's true.
Yeah. If you look at the data that we got, we get the impression that more than half of the big insurers in some jurisdictions would get captured. Now, I don't think our intention was ever to capture all of the insurers, and I think, as Sue points out, it seems to me that some of the tension we're hearing about is a mismatch in expectations of who the population ought to be. Never mind whether we've actually got a test that captures it. I think our test possibly captures closer to what we intended than some of the things we had heard.
And the reason why I'm asking the question is not because I'm not hearing your arguments. It's more so that you understand what the questions will be that someone like me is going to ask the staff if this comes back in comment letters, so that you can think about how you would respond to those questions when you're formulating your ideas. That's really the purpose of it.
I see that point. I think the counter-argument to that would be, and that's really coming from a political process, if I think further in terms of endorsing that amendment, there is the argument of level playing field. So if you compare insurer with insurer, then the argument is, okay, why do they qualify, why can't I qualify? I mean, obviously, we can try as best as we can in order to make sure that that wasn't the intention at the outset, but the question is, does that argument really carry weight in the political process? I have no idea.
Andrew, so you point a bit, this is a temporary problem, and
yep.
We shouldn't get to
begs the question that do we need to do anything at all? I mean, it's a temporary thing and we've got all this fuss.
Well,
but that could just explain the volatility for 3 years.
Well, the question is
a bit superficial.
Good try.
I think
there are entities that are going to be.
Well, absolutely, and I think for some, especially as I said, that don't have any life insurance business, they'd probably be happily applying IFRS 9. I think it comes down to really is it really the core problem that you were being told is the core problem, i.e. the volatility thing. If it was just that, probably my answer would be different. But if you set for all the arguments that Francoise has laid out with running two systems in parallel, and don't get me wrong, this is never calculating stock. So it's never about calculating a fair value in a given point in time. The difficult thing about doing that in parallel is the flows. And attributing that to...
Aren't you arguing with me then?
No. I'm just saying that I think there are arguments for those to defer if keeping up the two systems is really very burdensome. I've been in charge for implementing old IAS 39 at a bank. I can tell you, if you do it, assets without the liabilities, just nonsensical. So it really depends on how the insurance business is being run and how much intertwined the insurance liabilities are with the assets. There are some insurers where it is highly integrated, and for these, I think there is a case to be made that you do it in one go. It isn't to say that they are all the same. I'm just saying I can understand their argument based on my prior experience.
I'm just interested because the whole debate here today is the scope and how it should be implemented. Nobody's raised the question as to whether it should be implemented at all. So it's sort of been a given in the whole conversation that there is a problem and there has to be a solution.
Well, we as a board have moved beyond that point.
No, it's an exposure draft.
Yeah, that's right.
Patrick?
finding the right solution and making it simple, we have to go back to the reasons why we're looking for a solution. Reason why is that, one, in insurance activities, if you do not have a treatment for assets and liabilities that is coherent, you create significant problems, which was our initial starting point. The second reason to find an appropriate solution is that conglomerates do exist. There are significant conglomerates, at least in Europe. So that's the reason why, if you want to tackle the two problems, the idea of going, and if you want to avoid as much disruption as possible in the banking industry, I accept the point made by Andreas, but for me it's not on the ground of option, it's a ground of materiality, quite frankly. So that's something somehow different, which I park. So I would do it on the basis of the activities performed by each and every entity, and frankly it's not very difficult. Maybe there are cases we need to explore during the exposure draft and the consultation, but I think that the vast majority of entities would be clearly either on one side or the other, and therefore you don't create for the 3 year period a huge disruption. Just wanted to say that again, sorry.
Stephen?
I wanted to ask Andreas about the cost aspect of overlay and the stocks and flows. Presumably, we're dealing with situations of either AFS assets moving to fair value P&L or cost assets moving to fair value P&L. Presumably, your argument doesn't apply to the AFS assets because you already have both the stocks and the flows because the flow is going through OCI. So it's only the cost assets that move to fair value P&L because of failing the SPPI test.
And it would then be the impairment model to the AFS population as well, because the AFS test is different under 39 than it is to IFRS 9 on the old OCI population.
But you'd just be keeping your existing impairment model. that there'd be no need for a new impairment model for those assets because they moved to fair value P&L. I wonder, do we have any analysis of how many of the affected assets are existing cost assets as opposed to AFS assets? Because that will then affect the assessment of this cost of the overlay approach.
So we're getting that data for you, Stephen.
Yeah.
For which you have fair value disclosures anyway.
Yes, agreed. So we have the fair value number, but Andreas's point
yeah,
is then converting that into
yeah.
the...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a zero. It's not a zero starting point.
No. I'm agreed.
Okay.